Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This episode is the edited version of a live session from the Jaipur Literature Festival 2021. 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time. Greg Brown in conversation with B. Rowlett. There
Welcome to Jaipur Literature Festival, and gosh, it took a long time to get through Craig's awards. Craig Brown is indeed a very renowned satirist and writer. Thanks for joining me here, Craig. We're here to talk about his latest book, 1, 2, 3, 4, The Beatles in Time. And it has a beautiful description here on the back. It's a kaleidoscopic biography that joyfully echoes the frenetic hurly-burly of an era. And we all know the JLF crowd loves nothing more than frenetic hurly-burly. So well done, audience, you're in the right place. So the Beatles provided the soundtrack to at least part of the soundtrack of the lives of every human being on the planet. And Craig, I can't be the only person in wondering, what more is there to say about the Beatles?
Well, there have been an amazing number of books about the Beatles, almost as many about Hitler or King Henry VIII or the other, or the ancient Egyptians. Basically there isn't much more information to get on the Beatles themselves, because their lives are chronicled to a bizarre extent. You can certainly find out what each of them was doing on any day of their lives, just about after the age of about five. And almost any hour of any day, if you look, you know, there are sort of complete Beatles obsessives who chronicle these things.
You meet quite a few of them along the way, don't you?
I think what hasn't been chronicled so well is the outer circles of the Beatles and the fans of the Beatles, which basically include about half the world. Even the people who hated the Beatles, haven't been chronicled, the intellectuals. And also the people who sort of fell foul of the Beatles, not because of anything the Beatles themselves did, which was vindictive, but just they were just washed away by the kind of tide of history, by the music the Beatles brought in and the type of way of looking at life that the Beatles brought in. Suddenly, the old guard, like even Elvis Presley to some extent, certainly Frank Sinatra, going back a bit further, Noel Coward, they were all put out. And I have one little chapter on Helen Shapiro, who was this big 16-year-old star who was top of the bill on a tour which the Beatles were on the bottom of the bill. And as the tour went on, the Beatles were getting higher and higher up the package. And Helen Shapiro was suddenly on the tour bus, read this headline in the Daily Mirror: "Is it all over for Helen, age 16? And so there are these people, or the singing nun is another. I could go on, but there are these marginal figures I find very interesting. So my book is more about, in a way, about the effect of the Beatles than about the Beatles themselves. So it does give
one of those effects, which I think you've portrayed really beautifully, is you pick moments in the lives of future megastars who don't know yet, but that the first listening of "She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah" turns out to be a transformative moment in their lives. Can you talk about some of those?
Yes, I mean it particularly occurred in America, where in England, the Beatles have been kind of bubbling to the surface or to the top over about a year, 1963, the whole of 1963, the end of 1962, 1963, they were getting bigger and bigger. But in America, it was only in January 64 they suddenly hit the top of the charts, and then almost immediately they went on a tour of America, because Brian Epstein cleverly had thought they mustn't go until they got a number one, and then they were on the Ed Sullivan Show, which was the big show in America, and something like 60 million people watched the Beatles topping the bill of the Ed Sullivan Show. And so everyone of that, say who were 10 to 15 then, was watching and can remember watching. And people like Bruce Springsteen, Creedence Clearwater Revival, there's a whole lot of people. Chrissy Hynde. Mm. And they suddenly all wanted to be like the Beatles, and they felt this kind of great liberation. Also in America, it had come just after, in November, Kennedy had been assassinated. So there was this kind of funereal feel to America. And then the Beatles came along. As John Updike said, it was like the sun coming out on Easter morning. And I think everyone was transformed. And of course, it started the great generational divide, because almost all the people, like Bruce Springsteen, remembered seeing it with a father or an uncle who hated them, you know, said, look at that, they hated the long hair, which now looks to us almost kind of military style shortness.
Yeah. It's almost the invention of teenagers, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the invention of teenagers. I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Do you think the Beatles could have happened at any other time?
I think they couldn't happen today, just because pop culture, which in some ways they pioneered in some ways, it is now so all over the place, and there are so many pop groups doing well, and all television stations have pop stars on. You know, they are so it couldn't happen now because there are just too many choices, and also certainly in America, you know, you have country and Western stations or hip hop stations. You don't have the sort of general station. So it's got compartmentalized. And I suppose it couldn't, I mean, it sort of had to happen then, because it was sort of, they were the immediate post-war generation. They were all born in the war, and their parents were all people who had served in the war. And so I think you needed that generational divide, and this which I do go into in the book. You know, there's a whole generation of people aged 20, like my father, my father-in-law, who were getting shot at, seeing their friends killed. And then, you know, it's only 20 years later, this new generation just having age 20, having fun. And being carefree and not listening to their parents. And so there was a great kind of culture shock in that. And I can understand it from both points of view.
You say, when we talk about the Beatles, we talk about ourselves. What do you mean?
Well, in a way that was, it was part of my excuse for writing the book, because I sort of feel, I was born in 1957, so I was six or seven when the Beatles surfaced. And then 10 years later, in 1970, I was 13 when they split up. And so they just were just part of my mind and my head for all that very formative period. And so all my memories of their song, you know, I don't know how many times, say Yellow Submarine or something, or a better song, Hey Jude.
Yeah, well, I really hate Yellow Submarine.
I probably heard Hey Jude, well, before writing the book. Obviously, while I was writing the book, I was listening to it a lot. But, you know, you probably hear it 20 times, each Beatles song, in major Beatles song, 20 times a year. So they are in your head, like it or not. And so everyone has their own version of where they heard each song, all the personal memories. And so each song is different for each person. I mean, you could say that of all music, but it's particularly true of the Beatles because of their ubiquity.
That's true. And I think you've managed to reflect that ubiquity and in the description I gave at the beginning, that it's a kaleidoscopic book, which I think is just right. It has a very sort of glinting, refracted quality. We get glimpses from different angles and from different lives. And you also play with the other biographers' accounts, which I love. You place them side by side and talk us, you know, it's quite teasing. Can you talk us through some of that process?
Well,
I think
there's
many different versions and they're all true.
Yeah, well, and you'll have noticed as a biographer that when you look up almost any detail, say about Mary Wollstonecraft, so on, everyone has a slightly different take on everything, and even days or what the weather was like. I mean, I find often in biographies, not particularly but you know, people say it was a it was a stormy day when, you know, Jane Austen went to Salisbury Cathedral. So, and they put this sort of colour in. I might be particularly true of, or particularly peculiar with the Beatles, because it's such recent history. You'd think, well, people can judge this. I mean, the bit I could have signalled out virtually any detail, any description as having lots of different versions. The one I single out is this comparatively minor event, but at, I think it's Paul's 21st birthday in Liverpool, John gets into a fight with a local disc jockey called Bob Wooler. And it's basically over whether John had had an affair with Brian Epstein when they'd gone on holiday to Spain together. And I do about 10 or 12 different accounts from just little brief things. Just showing, you know, some people say, well, he hardly had a bruise. Other people say he was rushed to accident and emergency, you know, nearly died. And just everyone has a different account. And the, a lot of these accounts are from people who were at the party. I think I mentioned somewhere Paul McCartney once said that in any account of an earthquake, if there are 1,000 people in the earthquake, there'll be 1,000 different accounts. And then that's particularly true. I mean, the trouble with writing a biography, as you'll have found, is that it's tedious to question each detail, you know, and to give all the different versions of each detail. So you have to choose. And so I try to stop myself being pedantic all the way through the book. And I try to choose what I considered the most likely account, the most.
I thought it was fascinatingly done. I want to pick up on something. You did an additional article in the Daily Mail, though. And, you know, reveal some of his quite cruel and bullying behaviour. Did you want to be more neutral on that terrain in the book?
Well, I was rather shocked when I was researching the book by quite how much, how awful John was in lots of ways, particularly in his youth. Now, you know, we've all done things we regret and said things we regret in our youth. And so I had this quite a long, I did a lot of research and I had lots of files on different aspects, and certainly under C for cruelty for John, there was lots. And I just thought, I didn't really want to put it in the, I mean, I put in some in the book, but I didn't want to outweigh it. And there was lots of anti-Semitism, which I find, you know, like everyone sensible find, you know, revolting. And he was very anti-Semitic in a kind of knee-jerk way when he was sort of 17, 18. He had a thing about disabled people. He would tease them in the streets and that kind of thing. And I just thought putting too much into the brew would mess it up. I wasn't trying to do a kind of hagiography of him.
No, I'd say that the tone is one of great affection and love. But there's one area where the satirist in you kind of bursts out like the Incredible Hulk. And yes, it's, we need to talk about Yoko Ono. Because yes, I've always had this idea that there was a sort of shred, more than a shred of misogyny and racism in the public perception of her. There was a sense of, you know, how dare this foreign woman break up the Beatles when, you know, yes, of course the Beatles were going to break up. But she really doesn't emerge well from your pages, and I have to say, reading it. Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, I mean, I don't think she broke up the Beatles. I think they would have broken up anyway. She certainly didn't help. she was the only... I mean, even Brian Epstein didn't go into the studio, and certainly he didn't go into the actual studio. He might have gone occasionally into the sound booth, but she just plonked herself that there and then would issue commands. And, you know, George, who was probably with Ringo, the easiest going, you know, she started eating his biscuits, and they were already fractious. They were tired. They'd taken too many drugs. I mean, John and Yoko were very on heroin and on LSD. So she didn't help matters, but I certainly wouldn't say she broke out the Beatles. That was going to happen anyway. However, I do think, I mean, because she's Japanese, yeah, there certainly was racism at the time. Nevertheless, you can't, you know, there can be something wrong. Just because you're Japanese, it doesn't mean you're saintly.
There's some very strange behaviour, I must say. It was a bit of an eye-opener to me. We've got so much to cover, so I'm going to bounce onwards. Can you tell us about Rishikesh? Obviously, we've got a huge Indian audience today. Tell us about the Beatles in India.
Well, it is rather a fascinating period in their lives. I mean, I think they met the Maharishi. They went to see him in Wales just for a weekend, and other people like Mick Jagger went too. And during that weekend, this was in 67, I think it was kind of August 67, don't it? During that weekend, they got a phone call and they'd heard that Brian Epstein had died, aged only, I think, 32, 33, their manager, who had really masterminded their success. I mean, he was completely...
We can't really overestimate the importance of Brian Epstein.
He was completely essential to kind of cleaning him up for the general public. He's very, very good at organizing tours and everything. He just did it like a kind of great general. And he was very much a father figure. Even after he died, talking to each other, they would call him Mr. Epstein. You know, they didn't call him Brian all the time. You know, they had a great respect for him and he adored them. And they suddenly heard that he died. The Maharishi said, you know, I'll be your father now. He sort of slightly forward, I think. He sort of said he'd jump into the gap. I mean, then they didn't see the Maharishi for a time, but then in February 68, they went to Rishikesh. And all four of them, including Ringo, who was the most reluctant, the least interested in the, you know, Eastern spiritual life. And Ringo took a whole lot of baked beans and things with him because he was worried about the Indian food. I mean, to some extent, you can understand why, because he'd been very ill as a child. Had to be careful. And they spent some weeks in India. George was obviously who was the one who had pushed them into going in the first place. He was the most, I mean, throughout the rest of his life, he was very interested in Eastern religion. The others, Paul McCartney still meditates, so it had a lasting effect on him too, in a kind of mild way. And John, being John, he was there. He'd already met Yoko. He hadn't broken up with Cynthia. Yoko was sending him messages to Rishikesh, you know, so he was in a very conflicted state. And in the end, it ended in tears, in a way, certainly tears for the Maharishi. Because they had this very creepy friend called Magic Alex, who was kind of stirring it. As far as I can see, it's hard to know exactly what went on there.
But, he's one of those brilliant minor characters as well, yeah. Isn't he? Magic Alex.
But he put about the rumour that the Maharishi had tried to leap on Mia Farrow's sister. And then John took this as an excuse. John, who's getting a bit fed up, wanting to get back, took this as an excuse. And so they left in sort of high dudgeon, and it ended in tears, but it did have a lasting effect. They also, it had a very positive effect in that they might have taken a bit of dope, but they weren't taking hard drugs while they were in India. And it made them very productive. A lot of the songs on the Double White album came from their few weeks in India. So it was a productive time for them.
I want to talk about, there's a beautiful exploration of the lyrics, and you talk about the influence of the great Victorian nonsense writers, Edward Lear, Lewis Carroll. I'd like to talk a little bit about that, but there's a wonderful quote, which I'm just trying to find. You mention...
It's a very hard book to find things. It doesn't go chronologically.
Don't worry, I've got my little trusty sticky bits of paper everywhere. You say... You've distracted me and now I've lost it, Craig.
Sorry.
Lyrics removed from music are like fish removed from water or butterflies pinned to a card. They're indivisible. So the significance of the lyrics, and obviously there's been a huge amount of kind of academic and some of a bit bonkers debate into the meaning of the lyrics, but please can you talk about the important influence of Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll?
Yes, I like that sentence. I mean, you shouldn't like, you should like your own sentences, but, you know, I'm glad I said that, because actually often you see these lyrics of any songs quoted as if they were pure poetry, and of course they're not. They, you can't divide them from the music. John Lennon was always, as a schoolboy, he didn't do well at school, but he was very bright, and you can just tell from his writings at the time. And he loved Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll, the two great nonsense writers of the English language. And he loved all their wordplay, their puns, their sense of the preposterous, the surreal, I suppose the word would be now. And there's a friend of mine actually called Stephen Bailey, who was at school. He was kind of 10 years younger than the Beatles. He was at school in Liverpool, in John Lennon's old school. And he wrote John a letter in about 65, I think, saying that his teacher, John's old teacher, in fact, was now teaching the Beatles lyrics in their English classes. You know, quite a clever way of getting boys involved. And John thought this was terribly funny, and he started upping the nonsense of the lyrics in order to kind of tease English teachers, or the kind of nowadays professors like Christopher Ricks, or, you know, these professors who take them terribly seriously. And in some ways,
can you share the example? Because it's so good.
What was it? I am the walrus, was it? Or I can't remember what example.
Well, he's clearly delighting the idea of people mystifying over it.
Yes, well, I mean, they're bonkers lyrics, and they're loosely based on the Walrus and the Carpenter, the Lewis Carroll poem. But actually, it's a kind of misreading of the poem, and so it doesn't kind of... and, you know, I am the Walrus, goo 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 goo. And then there are lots and lots of just bits and pieces which John puts in. And of course, over time, when you hear a song over and over again, it takes on a meaning of its own. And as I was talking about each song meaning something different to each person. And so I think as long as a song becomes famous enough, it doesn't really matter whether it has an objective meaning or not. It has some kind of weird meaning inside your head. And everyone's head is nonsensical at all. I mean, you only have to remember what dreams you had last night to realize that there's lots of nonsense going around in your head. And it's only a weird filter which allows us to talk sense every now and then.
And what about the references to their hapless nemesis, the police officer?
I can't remember the lyrics in being so early in the morning in England. He had this, there was a policeman called Norman Pilcher, who I devote a chapter to. Norman Pilcher is still going, I was horrified to see. But Norman Pilcher was absolutely determined to get the Beatles on a drugs bust, and actually succeeded. But
it sort of does stakeouts on their various properties and harasses their friends and pops into their bedrooms. And
yes, and so there is a kind of reference. Now can you remember? Is it on your page? The Pilcher banana.
He's Semolina Pilcher, isn't he?
Semolina Pilcher. Yes, so of course Pilcher, yeah, so he could have been put in as Semolina Pilcher. So in a way, for his efforts, he has been immortalized in English verse or English lyrics, yeah.
tell us, was there anything in the writing of the book that surprised you?
I think the key thing that surprised me, which should have been glaringly obvious, was quite how young they were. I think it's because I was so much younger than them at the time. They seemed to me like adults when they were only 20. But, you know, George was 17 when they went to Hamburg. They were all under the age of 30 when the Beatles split up. I mean, it's an extraordinary idea that all this amazing achievement, all this energy, all this kind of world-changing force was all over by the age of 30. And just so... how young they were, which also I think makes things like when I was talking about John's cruelty, that makes it much more forgivable because they were kids, and all the mistakes they made and the drugs they took. You know, I think in a way it's extraordinary they withstood the pressure of fame so well rather than that they succumbed to it.
I knew very little about the Hamburg episode, actually, and they were so incredibly young and so very inexperienced in all matters of life. Tell us a little bit about the Hamburg chapter.
Well, in Hamburg, they were definitely just kids, and they hadn't gone. I think they hadn't gone abroad. And George's mother sent him off in the van with a sort of, you know, little packed lunch,
and they weren't successful yet at all, were they?
They're all living in two rooms without windows in the most disgusting, and they'd have to wash in the kind of gents' toilets of the nightclub they were performing in. So it was revolting, but of course, you know, if you're 17, 18, you can withstand revolting experiences and quite enjoy them, I think. And so they were a gang, and I think one of the joys of the Beatles, and one of the things which made them last so long, you know, before they split up, was this sense of a gang that developed in Hamburg, that they knew each other really well, they'd played together for a long time. And so when they then became famous, kind of all of a sudden, certainly in America, it was them against the world, and they were a real unit. And you can see this if you look at YouTube videos of their press conferences in America. They're a completely self-contained unit. They're uncowed by being abroad, by being cross-questioned by the top American media, you know, vast gymnasiums full of journalists. And that's because they're a little gang together, and they're still trying to make each other laugh. And there's something very sweet about that.
That's actually very poignant, isn't it? When you consider, I mean, it's amazing that they lasted so long given the pressures that they were under. But when you consider how it does start to sort of fray at the edges and then disintegrate, describe that part of their trajectory.
Well, I think it was bound to, because these four very definite figures. I say that in the book that they were, it sounds a bit glib, but it kind of works, that they were like the four elements, that John was fire, and Paul was water, George was air, and Ringo was earth. And if you see them like the elements, that's what made them work. It gave them the world. But it also meant that when they each became independently wealthy, they each had their own home lives. I mean, three of them were married by 66. And they each had their own sort of fan base. And so they were bound to want to go their own ways. George felt underused, which is probably true. They gave him kind of maybe two tracks, an album, and he wanted to do more. He felt he was the sort of number three in the group. And John and Paul were such different characters, which actually made their songs together so good. That's what gives them the energy, but that energy was bound to break up eventually. And Paul went more melodic, and he was more sentimental, and John was kind of angrier and more peculiar. And so it was bound to break up. But I think it's extraordinary that they lasted as a sort of famous group for 7 years.
Some of the excesses that you describe of their incredibly wealthy years and the sort of acolytes that hang around them, and then some of the business proposals that stem from this extraordinary wealth, where they go, if you've got a really great and mad idea, we'll just throw money at it. Talk about some of the people that came on the scene at this stage, because it's very funny.
Yes, well, this was after Epstein. It wouldn't have happened with Epstein, you see. He was a very good businessman. But they were, their tax advisors said, well, you know, you either give this money to the taxman or you start a company. They started a company on kind of utopian principles, that they wanted to give people like them a big chance. So they said, you know, put in an ad saying, send us tapes. And of course, no one had the time or energy to listen to these tapes. So great cupboards in their building. They bought this smart building in Savile Row full of people's tapes unheard. They did actually start Apple Records. And I remember as a child buying the first five or six Apple records, including the Radha Krishna Temple singing Hare Krishna, which got, it didn't go to the top of the charts, but it must have gone into the top five. I mean, it showed the Beatles following, that something as strange as that to English ears would get into the top five. So they did some good stuff, and Billy Preston and people. But they also started, you know, a boutique and things like that. They wanted to start a limousine company. They wanted to be like Amazon is now in a funny way. And they just didn't have the application. They didn't have the ability to be managers. They didn't have the application. They weren't interested in the day-to-day running of it. And so, of course, a lot of charlatans and hangers-on just came in. And the one point, Apple was sort of occupied by Hell's Angels who were just wanting free food and just odd bods, you know. It was a sort of utopian nightmare. It became a dystopia, I suppose.
Is that in the story of it, is there a particular aspect, is there a particular part of the trajectory that you personally gravitate to that connects most to you as a writer?
What, of the whole story or just the Apple
game? Yeah, I mean, it's something of an epic, isn't it? You know, it's the
yeah, it is. I mean, in a way.
And it's at times so bonkers, but there are moments of poignancy and moments of just humanity. And
yes, I mean, I think it is. I only think now, I think you only really understand your books having written them. I didn't really know what I was doing while I was writing it. But I now see that there is this kind of, there are lots of stories, but the central one of these four working class boys from Liverpool in the space of a year or two becoming almost the foremost famous people in the world, certainly the foremost famous young people in the world, and influencing, you know, things like Putin and Gorbachev have said that they were a major influence on the idea of freedom in the Soviet Union for that younger generation. I mean, so there's that extraordinary story. And then there's the story of fame and how it hits, how people deal with fame and how people deal with wealth when they're only kind of 20. I think Paul was told that he was a millionaire by his account when he was sort of 22. I mean, these were people who had no money at all. And then all the pressure, amazing pressures on them, far and away more than you'd, a pop star now would have, because people now have a sort of infrastructure to deal with it. I find actually one of the poignant things is John's aunt Mimi, who rather like Yoko has been demonized by some people in the past. But she was this very strict auntie who brought him up strictly because his mother was a kind of tearaway. She was took charge of John. And so she's demonized as being very anti-Beatle, you know. But there's something very sweet about her love of John and John's love of her. Right up until the end of his life, he was ringing her every week. And he said the reason he didn't want to come back to England from New York was because he didn't want to have to say goodbye to Aunt Mimi for the last time. These things are very touching, I think.
So yeah, these small details actually really do sort of just, you see them in a very humane light. And it also gives some sense to, I mean, there's that famous quote where John Lennon said, you know, is in the explosion that was their takeover of America, and it's at that point that he says, oh, we're more famous than Jesus. Yeah. And which is sort of seems like a flippant remark now, but it's almost hard to comprehend that scale of their impact and fame at that time.
I think he was just being pretty accurate in a funny way.
Yeah, you know,
yes. He was certainly on the front page more than Jesus.
Some questions have come in from the audience, Craig, and someone wants to know, Amrita asks, what's your favourite Beatles song or album?
Well, my favourite album, I think, is Abbey Road. That second side of Abbey Road, the medley. I think that just has everything. I remember when I was writing it, I was talking to someone who's in a rock band, and he was saying the whole thing about the Beatles is this amazing variety you get often within each song. And it's like the elements I was talking about. You know, you get
are you evading picking a favorite though, Craig,
and everything and Craig, I think you get that on the medley.
You're evading picking a favourite.
I know. I'm afraid.
Have to take one to a desert island disc.
If I had to choose one, I'd choose Hey Jude. Actually, I just find it still moving, and those first bars and Paul's voice coming in, and there's
the beautiful backstory, of course, that you describe in the book. It's very very tender backstory to that.
Oh yes, because he wrote it originally for John's son Julian. It was going to be called Hey Jules.
Yeah. Yeah. We have another question, and this is an interesting one, actually, because I do want to tell the audience of your extraordinary career as a satirist in the one and only Private Eye, which is Britain's mainstay of satire, in which you, you know, just skewer the famous and the mighty amongst us. Someone has an interesting satire question here. It's Anuj asking, is it hard to satirise people or people of power like Trump and Johnson? Do you think censorship is seeing an end to parody?
Well, I think actually there's more comedy than ever. And actually, I gave up on Trump. I was quite kind of early to do him. I was doing it before he was president for Vanity Fair and American magazines like that. But in the end, there was so much comedy, and also obviously Trump was providing his own, you know, idiocies, and so I gave up on that. So I don't think there's I mean, obviously people are becoming more priggish.
What do you mean by priggish?
Well, for instance, if I did someone like Greta Thunberg or someone, and there is a kind of comical aspect of her, a lot of people would be very, very upset. Or even someone like Yoko Ono. You know, people do get very upset. They don't always see the joke.
I've just had my computer's about to restart. I've just had a thing flash up on the screen, so I'm incredibly sorry to, and I don't know how to get rid of that.
If you disappear, I'll just carry on.
And yes, there's a beautiful ending question. It's come through from Ellen. How do you see the impact of the Beatles in the cultural fabric of the 21st century? And how and why does the music still attract the generation of younger audiences? I'm terribly sorry if my computer's about to fold down. I cannot get rid of this thing.
It probably won't.
Answer that question.
I'll
try and fix this.
I think the question was about why are they still popular? And they certainly are. I mean, it's the odd thing is if you meet 10-year-olds today, they will know most of the Beatles songs. Right at the end of the book, I have a quote from the British philosopher Brian McGee, who wrote in 1967, "Is anyone seriously saying that the Beatles will still be famous 50 years from now?" And of course, he's been completely proved wrong. They are as famous almost as they were in their prime. Now, why is that? Because obviously sociological reasons have been and gone. We're no longer in the post-war generation, all that kind of thing. I think it's because of the quality of the music. Paul McCartney had this amazing gift for melody. It just sort of poured out of him like magic. And I think any great melodies last. And then John gave it this kind of spice and interest, and he stopped it being too sentimental. And their harmonies, I think just as a group, their musicianship shouldn't be underrated, that they had these great harmonies, which are also, you can hear on, all their songs, but particularly on those tracks I was talking about on Abbey Road. And so it was just that kind of combination. And also, which is less evident now in their popularity, is that their characters were like characters from a kind of comic book or from a novel or something. Everyone had their own favourite Beatle. And so that sort of helped in the beginning. I think now probably the younger generation wouldn't be able to tell, you know, whether George was singing or John, and probably wouldn't be that interested. They just like the music, and the music has lasted. Against all, everyone's betting, the music has lasted. Has your machine got better?
It's still got this thing, and I just don't understand what it is. I was just messaging Critica to see what on earth's going on. I really do apologise for that. And thank you for soldiering on, you know, against these digital odds. I think you've just summed it up very beautifully. And the questions that are coming in are very much on that theme. But I think we will probably have to end here now. And I just want to thank you, Craig, for creating such a piece of joy. I'd like to urge everybody to buy this book by Craig. You should be able to go online and buy it now, not from Amazon, but from anywhere else. The Beatles in Time by Craig Brown. Thank you so much, Craig. And thanks, everybody.
You did a really good job. Thank you, keeping me in control. Okay.
It's been wonderful. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow to this show wherever you're listening to this.